This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Timothy Noah is a senior editor at The New Republic, where he writes the TRB column. He was for a dozen years a senior writer at Slate, where he wrote the Chatterbox column, among other duties. Prior to that, he was a Washington-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal, an assistant managing editor for the U.S. News and World Report, a congressional correspondent for Newsweek, and an editor of the Washington Monthly, where he remains a contributing editor. Noah has written for a variety of other national publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Harper's, and Fortune. He received the 2011 Hillman Prize for a 10-part Slate series on income inequality in the U.S. that he subsequently expanded into his 2012 book, The Great Divergence: America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. The reviews have been extraordinarily favorable to his book, pointing both to the breadth of his analysis and the scope of the problem that faces us as a democracy. Jonathan Alter writes, "Timothy Noah has taken the most consequential domestic issue of this or any election and made us understand it in a completely new way. The Great Divergence is a compelling, important, and hugely readable." He's referring, of course, to the book by that title, The Great Divergence. "I learned something new in almost every sentence," Alter writes. Walter Isaacson writes, "This book is profoundly fascinating and important. The growth of income inequality over the past three decades has caused a contentious partisan debate based more on ideology than fact. Timothy Noah provides a clear, dispassionate look at what has and has not caused this trend and what we can do about it. Everyone who cares about the future of America's middle class should read it." Reviewed in the New York Times just a couple years back, the reviewer concluded by saying, and I quote, "How much inequality can the Republic stand before the social and political fabric frays?" Noah did not answer the question, in part because he doesn't know, but mostly because he feels he doesn't need to. And then quoting Noah, Noah writes, "You'd have to be blind," he says, "not to see that we are headed in the wrong direction. And we've been heading that way for too long. The worst thing we could do to the Great Divergence is to get used to it." We have copies of that book, paperback book, available for purchase and signing, courtesy of the Book Den. Noah will be out front after the event for signing those books. He's going to talk to us tonight about inequality and the 2012 election. Please welcome him to Santa Barbara.
Thank you. You have water down here. Wonderful, thank you. Thank you, Wade. I'd also like to thank Leonard Wallach and the CAP Center for this wonderful opportunity to come here. I grew up in Los Angeles, but strangely, this is the first time in my life, in my 55 years, where I have ever been to Santa Barbara. And it's been, I know it's weird, isn't it? But it's been a delightful experience, and I'm so glad to be here tonight. Before I talk about inequality and this last presidential election, let me talk a little bit about what I mean when I say inequality. Inequality is a word that can describe all sorts of phenomena. And my book, The Great Divergence, focuses on one particular aspect of inequality, and that is income inequality, and specifically the growth in income inequality that began in 1979 and has continued ever since. Some people think that that's just the way capitalism works, but it's not the way capitalism worked in the United States from the early 1930s through the 1970s. Now, that period included a Great Depression and World War II, but it also included a phenomenal period of economic growth in the post-war era through the late 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and even into the 1970s. That trend towards greater income equality reversed itself in 1979. Ever since then, we've seen greater income inequality. There are a number of different types of inequality that I could be talking about. I could be talking about racial inequality. I could be talking about gender-based inequality. But this is a different kind of inequality. This is income-based inequality, and specifically, it's about the gap between middle-class earnings and earnings for the affluent and the very rich. I won't be talking a lot about poverty tonight because, as I say in my book, it was lousy to be poor in 1979, and it's lousy to be poor today. Relative to the middle class, situation, the income gap between the poor and the middle class, didn't change all that much for most of the period I'll be describing, except for the most recent 5 or 6 years. Since the recession, we have seen a divide open up between the middle class and the poor as the poverty rate has soared in the United States. Really, we're talking about a change in the relationship between the middle class and the affluent and the middle class and the rich. It didn't used to be lousy to be middle class in the United States. It used to be a pretty good deal. It has gotten to be a steadily less good deal over the years, and we have seen a fair amount of wage stagnation for the middle class, certainly relative to what occurred in the post-war years, certainly with respect to what's been happening to incomes at the top. And if you just look at the last dozen years, we've actually seen a slight decline in median income, which is very worrisome. If you factor in government redistribution through taxes and benefits, it's not a decline. It's been about flat. But that's, of course, nothing to write home about either. So I am talking about the growth in income inequality in the United States. I'm not talking about it at the global level. There has been around the world an increase in income inequality. But I won't be talking about that tonight for a couple of reasons. One is that it is not a universal trend. It is a common trend, but it is not a universal trend to see a growth in income inequality in comparable nations around the world. There are a number of countries where inequality has either been reduced or at least stayed flat. It's been reduced in Latin America. It has stayed flat in France. So obviously, it is not the law of nature that's driving income inequality. The other reason I'm focusing on the United States is because income inequality is worse here in the sense that it is growing faster and that it exists at a level that is much greater than income inequality in most comparable nations, advanced industrial democracies. So that's what I'll be talking about when I talk about income inequality tonight. I call it the Great Divergence, and that's a term that I borrowed from Paul Krugman, who used that phrase in his book, The Conscience of a Liberal, that came out about 7 years ago. So with that in mind, let's talk a bit about the role that income inequality played in this last election. The 2012 presidential election was the first in modern memory in which income inequality became an issue. The catalyst was the Occupy Wall Street protest in New York's Zuccotti Park, which began in September 2011. 3 months later, Obama delivered a major economic address in Osawatomie, Kansas. Osawatomie was where, a century earlier, Theodore Roosevelt had given his famous New Nationalism speech, denouncing, quote, a small class of enormously wealthy and economically powerful men, unquote. Obama sounded a similar theme. Inequality, Obama argued, wasn't just a problem in itself. It also made it more difficult for individuals to rise from the bottom to the top. 1 month later, the chairman of Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, Alan Krueger, elaborated on this theme in a speech at the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank in Washington. It was in this speech that Krueger presented a diagram called the Great Gatsby Curve, which I love that name. And that curve shows that it doesn't prove it, but it shows some tentative evidence anyway that as income inequality increases, economic mobility decreases, which is kind of intuitive. Isabel Sawhill, an economist at the Brookings Institution in Washington, has said, and President Obama has repeated this, that the ladder becomes harder to climb as the slats in the ladder grow farther apart. The rungs of the ladder grow farther apart. In an April 2012 speech at an Associated Press luncheon in Washington, D.C., Obama said, research has shown that countries with less inequality tend to have stronger and steadier economic growth over the long run. He pointed out that after two large tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, cuts that provided the greatest relief to high-income households, jobs growth was smaller than it had been during any other economic expansion going back half a century. Not what you'd expect. Yet, Obama said, Republicans favored another round of tax cuts advantageous to the rich, combined with draconian cuts to the federal budget. This line of attack was sufficiently damaging that eventually Mitt Romney, his opponent, pledged that his proposed tax cuts, which included a 20% across-the-board reduction in income tax rates, would be structured to maintain the existing tax burden on the rich. However improbable mathematically, this claim was easy for Romney to make because he was already refusing to disclose many significant details of his tax plan. So the question is inequality mucking up the economy? The Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz argues in his new book, The Price of Inequality, that the U.S. has already reached a point where income inequality is impeding economic growth. Other, quote, macro-egalitarians, as the economic journalist Jonathan Rauch has described them, are less certain about that. But nonetheless, they believe the accumulating evidence warrants serious attention. Quote, growth becomes more fragile, unquote, when a country experiences a high level of income inequality, Jonathan Ostry of the International Monetary Fund explained to the New York Times recently. Alas, the 2012 presidential election never became an entirely full-throated debate about income inequality. That was partly because Romney was reluctant to take up the issue. Early on, Romney suggested that, quote, and I love this quote, It's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms, unquote. But he complained that Obama was taking, quote, a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, unquote. Romney was a wealthy financier who'd made his fortune in the wildly lucrative and comparatively low-risk field of private equity. He well knew that made him personally vulnerable on the inequality issue, and he declined to release much information about the taxes he'd paid over the previous two decades. What little information he did release indicated that his effective tax rate was lower than that of many middle-class Americans. This was because his income was derived mainly from investments, which are taxed at a lower rate than wages. In 1 year, Romney paid a mere 13.66% of his income in taxes. There was evidence, too, that much of Romney's wealth was tied up in exotic investment instruments, some of them located in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Romney insisted he received no tax benefit from these offshore investments, but as Michael Gratz, professor of tax law at Columbia, observed tartly in a New York Times op-ed, quote, "Rich people don't send their money to Bermuda or to the Cayman Islands for the weather." Romney's labors, not to be perceived as a top-hatted plutocrat, suffered their greatest setback in September 2012 when Mother Jones magazine posted online a video showing Romney speaking at a private fundraiser in Boca Raton. In that speech, Romney spoke dismissively of the 47% of Americans, actually 46, I can't help but point out, who didn't pay federal income tax. These were people, Romney said, and I quote, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it, that that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them, and they will vote for this president no matter what. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives, unquote. That may be the quote that lost the election for Mitt Romney. This assertion was breathtakingly arrogant and also remarkably ignorant. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a Washington-based nonprofit, calculated that of these 46% of American households that didn't pay taxes, fully 61% were working people who just didn't happen to earn a sufficient amount to pay income tax. They all nonetheless paid plenty of federal payroll and excise taxes in addition to state and local taxes. And there was a recent report put out by Citizens for Tax Justice that actually looked at state and local taxes. They are remarkable. They are unbelievably regressive. You look at a chart that shows various incomes, and you see that the percentage of income paid in taxes literally goes down as income goes up. Another 22% were elderly, a group that tended to be cool to Obama, making it politically foolish for Romney to speak ill of them. The elderly didn't pay income tax because most of them didn't have much in the way of income. They were retired and living on Social Security and perhaps a private pension and relying on Medicare for health insurance. 7% of the non-taxpaying 46% were disabled or ill. Some but not all of these people received disability or some other government benefits. 3% were students, and 7% fell into the other category, which included those on welfare or collecting unemployment benefits. It was this 7%, and by this 7%, I mean 7% of the 46%, which is to say about 3% of the U.S. population, that Romney appeared to have in mind when describing the 47% of the population who didn't pay taxes. Romney's dismissal of the non-taxpaying 46%, which he quickly disavowed after it was made public, was relevant to the Great Divergence in two ways. First, it caricatured a large swath of the working class as malingerers, when in fact a clear majority of these 46 percenters were employed.
That Romney's ignorance and distaste was shared by many of the wealthiest Americans was suggested by the favorable reception Romney's discussion received at the Boca fundraiser, and you can see that if you look at the YouTube tape. During the previous year, the political scientists Benjamin Page and Jason Seawright of the Northwestern and Larry Bartels of Vanderbilt had written a paper based on newly available information about the political views of America's wealthiest 1%, a much more exclusive group, incidentally, than the 1% of Americans receiving the highest incomes, and how these diverged from the political views of all Americans. Most striking was the group's comparative indifference to the unemployment rate, which was then above 8%. Whereas a 51% majority of all Americans cited the economy, i.e. unemployment, as the most important problem facing the country, a 32% plurality of the wealthiest 1% cited the budget deficit as the most important problem facing the country. It seemed hardly coincidental that Congress and the White House were, at that time, lavishing much more attention on the problem of the deficit than on the problem of unemployment and a too sluggish economic recovery. They still are. The problems of the working class didn't seem to register. This, I believe, is one concrete, deeply harmful result of the widening social chasm between incomes of families at the middle and the top of the income distribution. Income divergence has fostered mutual alienation and growing mutual incomprehension between social classes. The other way that Romney's 47% remarks reverberated was in their implicit endorsement of the idea, rapidly acquiring respectability among influential Republican politicians, that everyone should have to pay at least some income tax. This broke with previous conservative orthodoxy, embraced by Ronald Reagan, among others, that government ought to shower the middle class and the quote-unquote deserving, i.e. working poor, with tax relief and tax credits. Reducing or eliminating tax liability for the middle class was necessary, it had been thought, to justify tax reductions for the rich, and thereby neutralize liberal accusations that conservatives were practicing, quote, trickle-down economics, unquote. Meanwhile, eliminating tax liability for the poor and expanding the earned income tax credit had been thought necessary to reward work and distinguish the deserving poor from the dependent poor on welfare. That was then. The new thinking, embraced by, among others, Senator Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina, recently appointed head of the Heritage Foundation, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Republican of Virginia, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, was that it was dangerous to free 46% of the population from paying taxes because members of that group would become acculturated to regard any government benefit they received as cost-free. Never mind that the 46% were still paying plenty of other taxes, including other federal taxes, that most of the 46% would later pay income tax as they became ineligible for certain tax credits, like the one for raising young children, and that there was no evidence the 46% were adopting a view of government spending any more favorable than the one they'd held before. As for conservatives' concern that they'd be seen favoring trickle-down economics, that taboo had diminished substantially over time. One clear benefit to Romney's 47% talk being made public was that it prompted a healthy and very public debate on the right about the wisdom of this new thinking. Among those who wanted nothing to do with it were such influential conservatives as William Kristol, Matt Welch, Jonah Goldberg, David Brooks, and Ross Douthat. The argument about whether the 46% should be compelled to pay income tax was highly relevant to any inequality discussion because during the Great Divergence, policies like the EITC and the reduction of tax liability for low-income and middle-class people had kept the federal income tax from becoming more regressive overall, in spite of very steep reductions in the top marginal rate. Reduction of income tax liability for lower-income people had been one of the few conservative policies to decrease income inequality. Now, many conservatives wanted to abandon it. President Obama must shoulder some of the blame for income inequality failing to become a dominant theme in 2012. He was happy to use it to attack Romney's proposed tax cuts or to argue for allowing the top marginal rate to return, as mandated by existing law, to 39.6% which Romney opposed. And Obama's campaign was more than happy to sound the theme when attacking Romney's previous career as a private equity tycoon who profited even as the businesses that his firm acquired laid off workers. But Obama stopped short of articulating a broad agenda to bring about greater income equality. For instance, he didn't argue for an increase in the minimum wage, one stimulus guaranteed not to cost the government a dime, even though he had promised an increase in the 2008 campaign and never really tried to deliver on it. One of the bolder policy solutions I propose in my book, The Great Divergence, is the imposition of government price controls on college tuition increases. After the book went to press, I was surprised to see Obama propose something very much like that in his 2012 State of the Union address, couched, of course, in milder language. His precise words were, quote, "Let me put colleges and universities on notice. If you can't stop tuition from going up, the funding you get from taxpayers will go down." But as Obama seldom discussed this idea on the campaign trail and did essentially nothing to follow through on his threat to college administrators, one had to ask how seriously he took the idea. Obama wanted to be seen as concerned about income inequality and is working to block anything that might increase it. He appeared nervous about proposing too many ways to attempt its reversal. In the end, Obama won re-election, though with a smaller share of the popular vote than he'd enjoyed in 2008. Exit polls yielded a somewhat contradictory picture of the concerns that animated voters. Slender majorities called in general for smaller government, and in particular for repeal of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare, the president's single most important accomplishment and certainly his greatest contribution to the cause of economic equality. But 60% of voters agreed that taxes needed to be increased, and when presented with a variety of ways to do that, a 47% plurality favored Obama's plan to tax incomes above $250,000 at a higher rate, compared to 35% who said nobody's taxes should go up and 13% who said everybody's taxes should go up. Voters expressed much concern about the economy and especially about unemployment, and strikingly 52% of voters said the country was on the quote-unquote wrong track. Kind of amazing. 52% said we were on the wrong track, but they voted for the incumbent anyway. But they didn't seem to assign much blame to Obama. A 54% majority approved of the job the president was doing. Obama's efforts to portray Romney as excessively privileged apparently worked. A majority of voters saw Obama as more in touch than Romney with people like themselves. Perhaps most tellingly, 55% complained that the economy favored the wealthy. Was this a mandate to tackle the problem of income inequality? If so, it was a fragile one. But presidents have struck out in bold new policy directions based on much less. In his inaugural speech, President Obama returned to this theme of equality, racial, sexual orientation, and economic. He began by quoting the Declaration of Independence, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Then he added, and I think this is a part of the speech that will be quoted in coming years, "While these truths may be self-evident, they have never been self-executing." Regarding income inequality, he said, quote, "Our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class." I interpret these words as a sort of acknowledgement and also a sort of promise. The acknowledgement is that inequality trends were highly unfavorable during Obama's first term. Indeed, they constitute a departure from a previous pattern that goes all the way back to 1948. The greatest income gains typically were under Democratic presidents for those at the bottom. Under Obama, the greatest income gains have gone to those at the top. According to the Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez, during the first 2 years of the economic recovery, 2010 and 2011, the top 1% saw its income rise by 11%, while the bottom 99% saw its income shrink by 0.4%. And that takes into account the fact that 2011 wasn't a particularly great year for the top 1%. In effect, Obama is promising that the second term will be different. That is almost certainly true, even if Obama doesn't do anything between now and 2016. Not that I'm recommending that. That's mainly because of the Obamacare law, whose most important provisions take effect this year and next. Obamacare will, through health insurance subsidies to the poor and middle class, many of whom have not previously been able to acquire health insurance, constitute the most dramatic government income redistribution in a generation. Obamacare will be funded in part by a new tax on high incomes, including capital income, raised not through the income tax, but through the Medicare tax. In addition, the Bush tax cuts have, as of January 1st, expired on income in excess of $450,000. Obama wanted a lower threshold of $250,000, but the Republicans insisted on $450,000. And that higher threshold means that the new tax will raise less money. That's a problem with regard to reducing the budget deficit. But it also means that the new tax will be more redistributive. Between these two tax changes, The Economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman estimates that the 1% will see its after-tax income fall by 6%, and that the 0.1%, and when we talk about the 0.1%, we're talking about top executives and financiers who are really driving the trend towards income concentration for the top 1%. That group will see its after-tax income fall by about 9%. Now, none of this will necessarily raise pre-tax cash income, as opposed to intangible income in the form of expanded health coverage, for the middle class. To achieve that, other measures will have to be taken, and I'm happy to talk about those after I'm done here. But it is a start, and for that, we should be grateful. Happy to take any questions. The question is, can I talk about the effect of the shrinking labor movement on the Great Divergence? Yes, the effect has been enormous. And I find it's interesting, as I've gone around the country and talked about this issue a great many places, and I find this is the one part of the story I find audiences resistant to, and weirdly enough, liberal audiences I find them very resistant to. Sort of more leftist audiences are very keen to talk about this, but sort of mainstream liberals are very squeamish about talking about unions these days. And I think that is a serious problem. What I tend to say to them is, if you want to talk about income inequality, if you're not willing to talk about the decline of labor, save your breath, because we're not going to get anywhere solving this inequality problem unless we figure out a way to revive the labor movement. I know it's a very hard problem. It's not a puzzle that any of us has an easy solution to, but the decline of labor has been a huge part of one kind of income inequality. I should say there are two kinds of income inequality that have been increasing over the last 33 years. One is the 1% versus the 99%, and that is a fairly simple story that has to do with the financialization of the economy, runaway CEO pay, a lot of things that you read quite a lot about. The other divide, the other kind of growth in income inequality has been between skilled labor and moderately skilled labor. People who have only a high school degree versus people who have a college degree, and increasingly a college degree won't get you there, graduate degrees. The causes of that type of inequality are complex. I would say that there are two major causes, and one is the failure of our education system to produce a workforce that's sufficiently skilled to meet ever-rising technological demands, which is, in essence, bid up the price of skilled labor. And the other is the decline of the labor movement. Belonging to a union used to be the equivalent of having a BA in terms of earning power. And clearly, when fewer people belong to unions, that is going to negatively impact how much they're going to earn. Also, more broadly, a strong labor movement has provided a hugely important role in influencing our politics in the direction of helping the middle class and helping the poor. Labor, even today, is really, I think, the only major institution in the United States that concerns itself with the well-being of the middle class and the poor. And it is in very bad shape. Union density in the early 1950s was about 40% when you include people who are covered by labor union contracts, and this is in the private sector. It has dwindled now to 7% in the private sector. When I see the term big labor used by people in the news media, I sort of feel like it's a cruel joke, like calling a bald person curly. Labor is not big anymore. It is small, and it needs to get big again. Right. The question is, has Obama given up on raising taxes further? I don't know whether he has or not, but I was very disheartened when, in the fiscal cliff negotiations, Obama didn't press Republicans harder and let the deadline of January 1st pass, because my sense then, and I think I was right, was that he was only really going to have one shot at increasing taxes. And it didn't seem to me that the Republicans were likely to let him do it again. And so he really had to go for broke and raise them as much as he possibly could. And letting that threshold drop, or rise rather, to $450,000, was, I think, a terrible mistake. So I guess my thinking is, after the fiscal cliff negotiations, he wasn't going to get another tax increase. So I'm not surprised that he's not pushing very hard for one now, but I am appalled that he didn't push for a better one at the end of December. Oh, sorry. The question is the environment an important part of the equality discussion? Right. Does social justice need to go with economic justice? I have to say, I don't really think the one has much to do with the other. I'm certainly in favor of tackling our environmental problems, particularly global warming. But I think when you're talking about green in the context of income inequality, the green you're really talking about is money. I don't see much of a connection between that issue and the environment, except that the sort of people who tend to be in favor of greater income equality also tend to be the sort of people who are in favor of stricter environmental regulation. The question is, would lifting the cap on the Social Security tax affect employment, affect the economy in any meaningful way? I think not. I think that it's a good idea to lift the cap on that tax, both because it would help reduce the deficit and also because the Social Security tax, as it stands now, is just a grotesquely regressive tax. Not only is it a flat rate for everybody up to $100,000 it is now, but above that level, the tax disappears. So it's regressive in two ways. And I would very much favor lifting that cap. And, you know, given the serious deficit problem that we face, I think not so much over the short term, but certainly over the long term, I think that we will see some give on that. I think, you know, already the Medicare tax, which is another part of the payroll tax, has become significantly more progressive. The question is, can we have a recovery that is sort of luxury driven? We've seen a little debate about this recently between Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz. Stiglitz has suggested that our recovery has been slowed, our current recovery has been slowed by the weak purchasing power of the middle class. And Krugman, who in general is very concerned about income inequality, has said that he's not so sure that in this particular recovery that's true. And he has said that, you know, it's possible to imagine a recovery that would be driven by luxury purposes. I'm not an economist, so I'm not in a great position to referee that debate. But I am a journalist, and as a journalist, I have observed there does seem to be more agreement among economists with Krugman's side of that argument than with Stiglitz's. But that's about as deep as I can go on that question. I do think that over the long term, the income inequality is very debilitating to our economy. And the reason is, I think that if you are earning at the median and you know that no increase in productivity is going to come back in the form of higher income, then what reason do you have to care about whether you're doing a good job? What reason do you have to care about how productive you are? What reason do you have to care about how well your firm does? What reason do you have to care about whether your country prospers? The only reason you have is fear of losing your job. And it seems to me that's a dangerous system, situation rather, economically. You know, we hear a lot of talk about the need for the job creators at the top of the income distribution to receive, you know, sufficient incentive. It seems to me that we also need to worry about incentives for the much greater number of people who are operating in the middle of this economy. How is income inequality affecting journalism? That is an excellent question. I don't think, you know, I think journalism has its own problems that really don't have a lot to do with these larger economic forces. You know, journalism, what we face in journalism is a disturbing change in technological, well, a disturbing change in our economic model that doesn't seem to be working as well as the previous economic model did. We may be seeing a decline in demand for our product, which is very dismaying. We are certainly seeing a decline in willingness to pay for our product, which is downright shocking. Journalism is in a very bad way, and that is a whole separate subject. The only connection I can make between journalism and income inequality. As part of my book, I talk about the phenomenon of offshoring. And, you know, offshoring's relationship to income inequality is a little more complicated than you might imagine. Clearly, offshoring has increased income inequality up till now. But the economist Alan Blinder at Princeton says that looking forward, he thinks that offshoring will stop increasing inequality. And the reason is, it's kind of a good news, bad news joke. The reason is that increasingly we will see an offshoring of higher income jobs. Like, for example, his. He said, why do I have to be standing in Princeton giving an economic lecture? Why can't a hologram of somebody from a low-wage country be giving that same lecture? Already we are seeing among financial journalists, I am sorry to report, Reuters. I discussed this in my book a little bit. Reuters has a number of financial journalists located in India. And sources are in India as well, because a number of brokerage houses have moved their analysts over to India. I mean, when you think about it, you can be an analyst anywhere, and you can be a financial journalist anywhere, as long as you have access to the data. A few years ago, when I was working at Slate magazine, I covered the Phil Spector murder trial, except that Slate didn't want to fly me to Los Angeles. So I just watched the video feed and wrote about it from the video feed. And of course, it occurred to me at some point while I was doing this, why does Slate need to pay me to do this sitting in Washington, D.C.? If I don't actually have to be in the courtroom, I could be anywhere. And I could be in Bangalore. And it was not a happy thought. The question is, why am I dismissing poverty from this story? And what I'd say is, poverty is certainly part, there is an inequality story having to do with poverty, but my focus again is narrowly on what has changed in this country is the relationship of the middle class to the affluent. That is the thing that has changed in the last 33 years. The relationship between the middle class and the poor hasn't changed much. So that's why I talk a bit about poverty, but I don't talk a lot about poverty in my book for that reason. There are ways in which this divergence between the middle class and the affluent has also hurt the poor in very meaningful ways. And the best example I can think of is that with the decline of labor unions, we have seen that a smaller portion of GDP now goes towards wages versus capital. Is obviously catastrophic, not only for the middle class, but for the poor. If there's less money being spent on wages, then that is a redistribution from wage earners to stockholders that is very damaging to people from the middle all the way down. I think that poverty is a very serious issue, and I think that we need to talk more about poverty. And as I said before, we have seen an increase in poverty over the last 5 or 6 years that we need to address. But I don't think that particular story is principally a story about inequality. I think it is principally a story about poverty. And I think we need to find ways to address poverty in separately and distinctly from the question of what we're going to do about economic inequality. The poor were poor before. The middle class wasn't poor before. And I am looking at what changed after 1979. The question is, why is there so little interest in reviving the labor movement, and why is the president not attacking inequality with greater vigor? I don't really know the answer to the second question. I was actually stumped when I contemplated Obama's failure to do anything about the minimum wage. Some people think that he did do something about the minimum wage, because the minimum wage did go up a little bit in, I think it was 2010. But that wasn't Obama's doing. That was a prearranged increase in the minimum wage. Obama campaigned saying he was quite separate and apart from that, going to raise the minimum wage gradually up to $10 an hour, I think it was. Now it's $7 and change. And I cannot for the life of me figure out why he didn't do it. I mean, I can guess that perhaps he was intimidated by accusations he imagined he would receive from conservatives that he was destroying jobs by raising the minimum wage. And there has long been an argument that when you raise the minimum wage, you destroy jobs. And there's a certain economic logic to that. But what most economists have increasingly come to agree on is that that job-destroying part of raising a consequence of raising the minimum wage is counteracted by an increase in productivity that you get when you rise when you increase the minimum wage. You know, go figure. You treat people decently, they perform their job better. This is what the evidence shows, and it seems to me he had plenty of research he could have pointed to that said, you know, show me. He could say, show me where increases in the minimum wage have hurt us in the past. They haven't. But he didn't do it, and I'm exasperated. Why has the country lost its interest in the labor movement? I think that there was some disillusion with the labor movement in the 70s and 80s. There was a feeling that labor was not reacting well to the changes in the global economy at that time. And there were a number of people, and I was guilty of this myself, writing at the time that labor unions had to become more flexible and they had to collaborate more with management, cooperate more with management. And what people like me didn't realize is that unions would eventually come to do that because they had to, and it didn't get them anywhere. And a big part of the reason why it didn't get them anywhere was because the laws in this country are just stacked overwhelmingly against labor unions. Labor unions have not been doing particularly well around the world in recent years, but they've been doing so much worse in the United States. And it is because we have very, very weak labor laws and very little interest in enforcing the weak labor laws that we have. I mean, we saw this last week when a court struck down Obama's appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. You know, those appointments were perhaps constitutionally questionable, but how did they come about? They came about because Senate Republicans were actively working to prevent Obama from appointing anybody to the NLRB. They didn't want the NLRB to have a quorum because they didn't want United States labor law to be enforced, even as weak as it is today. I think that, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think that we really need to give labor the tools to revive itself. And this has proven to be an extremely difficult thing to accomplish. Even Lyndon Johnson, during the Great Society days, when he was transforming the country, was unable to get labor legislation passed. Really, this problem goes back to the passage of the Taft-Hartley Law in 1947, which acted as a kind of slow-acting poison on the labor movement. And, you know, we need to persuade our government to give some support to labor unions, to allow people to organize into unions. And I think there's a lot of disillusion that's set in over the years about the weakness of labor unions, sometimes the corruption of labor unions. That's certainly been part of the story in the past. You know, what alternative is there to labor unions? And, you know, bosses are not going to pay workers well out of the goodness of their hearts. Sorry, the question is, slave labor in China? Slave labor in China. How can we compete against slave labor in China? Well, let me rephrase that more broadly. How can we compete against very low wages in China? There is a model that has proven successful in the past where a country has lower wages than we have. We compete with them. And as we engage with them and trade, eventually wages come up. This was the story in, for example, South Korea in the 70s and 80s. That model may well be followed in China, but you've got a problem with China, which is that China has a billion people. So it's going to take a really long time for wages to come up in China because they have so many people. They have been coming up in China, but they start from an unbelievably low level, and the increase is going to be very gradual, and so we are going to have a problem. Trade is going to trade with China is going to contribute to income inequality for the foreseeable future. Interestingly, trade really was not a major contributor to income inequality before the start of the 21st century, and that's because we weren't trading with countries that had we weren't trading with low wage countries. That changed when we increased trade with China, and when we increased trade to a lesser extent when we increased trade with Mexico. So this was a problem that really wasn't a problem for most of the period of the Great Divergence, but has become one. And I don't know what the answer to that is. Question is, what can we do about this? Well, I'm glad you asked, because that is the last chapter of my book. I have a number of suggestions for what we need to do, and I very consciously decided that if I limited my suggestions to things that would strike people as politically plausible right now, I would have a lot of policy suggestions that weren't going to do very much. I talked about this with James Carville, the former advisor to Bill Clinton, and he suggested that I have my practical problems in one, my practical solutions in one color ink, and my impractical suggestions in a different colored ink. I didn't follow him on that, but it seems to me that if you're going to talk about solutions, you need to talk about solutions that nobody's going to want to embrace right now, because we need to start a conversation. It took 30 years for this problem to develop. It's going to take a long time for us to fix it. So we need to start a conversation about what? About, for one thing, I think we need to raise taxes a lot more on the wealthy. Taxation did not get us into this problem because these income inequality figures are in pre-tax dollars. It's been worsened slightly by tax policies over the last 30 years, and we could make some improvements by raising taxes on the wealthy. So I think that we need to, people talk about the need to reduce the number of tax brackets. I think we need to increase the number of tax brackets and bring them all the way up to the top bracket, all the way up to 70%, which is where it was when Ronald Reagan was elected. That's one thing. I think we need to impose price controls, as I said, on college tuition. I think we need to have a federal jobs program, because I don't think that the private sector is going to be able to provide enough jobs to keep the middle class working. I think we need, and here's a relatively uncontroversial one, I think we need universal preschool education. There is everybody I know who's in the upper middle class sends his or her three-year-old to preschool every day, but I think only about 40% of all the three-year-olds go to school every day in this country. We need to have all three-year-olds going to preschool. I think that we need to re-regulate Wall Street. I think we need to break up the big banks. I think we need to put a choke chain on CEO pay. I think that... Those are a few suggestions right there. As you can see, most of them are not going to happen tomorrow.
I think we've reached that time, and practical suggestions seems like a good time to go out and start the crusade. So let's please thank our speaker.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.